Well, thank you very much, Dean, for that extremely warm introduction. It's been my experience in Adelaide on all of my trips that I've been very warmly received. In fact, this is a far larger turnout than I could possibly aspire to in Pittsburgh. So it's good being the new kid in school, I guess, is the motto there. But it's good most days until they take you out back on the playground and poke you a little bit. But it really is a pleasure to be here. It's particularly interesting for me to be here on the occasion, I guess, of what, by all accounts, is a truly historic and unprecedented victory. It's really quite remarkable, and I have to tell you, to be perfectly honest between you and me, I was a little bit skeptical. This isn't really the outcome I expected, but I guess Geelong had to win sometime. So I'm the dean of the Heinz School, as Dean said, but I'm actually here representing Carnegie Mellon, and our aspirations in Adelaide go well beyond the Heinz School. We are going to open in May, and we're going to offer two master's programs, professional master's program in public policy and one in information technology management. The Entertainment Technology Center at Carnegie Mellon, which is a joint effort of the School of Computer Science and the College of Fine Arts, is actually also going to open up a master's program in entertainment technology in May. And beyond that, we're quite hopeful that we're going to be able to entice any number of the units at Carnegie Mellon to come here and be part of this community and take part in all of the advantages that I've seen here, which are quite substantial. But these are challenging times for universities for a variety of reasons. There is fundamental change afoot in our economies, in our societies, in the markets in which universities operate in. And contrary to popular opinion, some of that opinion being ensconced in universities, we are not immune from that change. We are not actually ivory tower institutions that can afford to sit by and let the world change around us without responding to it. And my belief, for better or worse, is that universities are going to undergo really substantial transformations as we go through the next couple of decades. Indeed, our provost, Mark Camlett, my current boss, but the former dean of the Heinz School, is very fond of saying that universities and tertiary education systems are the last major service industry to undergo substantial structural reform. But it's coming, and indeed, I think it's here. And that's part of what I want to talk to you about is the changes that I see in the world and how I see universities changing as in response to that, or perhaps how they should change. I have a few caveats on this talk, though. One is that this talk is really something that springs out of my experience as dean of the Heinz School. It's not an academic talk. It's not well-grounded in research, although I read a lot of the research, obviously, that exists. But it's very much conditioned by my experiences and therefore somewhat, a reflection of the idiosyncratic nature of Carnegie Mellon. And so on my slide, I've annotated my topic for today to put the question to you is whether this applies to universities broadly or whether it really just applies to Carnegie Mellon. Second caveat I'll say is that universities are not monoliths. There's not one type of university. We come in as many different flavors and varieties as institutions in any industry. And so today I'm really talking about universities that look like Carnegie Mellon, that is, universities that have as a primary focus both education and basic research, universities that have international reputations, that kind of thing. That's not to say that these are the best kinds of universities or educational institutions in the world. It's simply what I know, and I don't pretend to know much about others. The third is I'm going to speak in gross generalizations, but hopefully that will be more entertaining than a lot of data. So let me give you a little bit of preview. It would seem from this slide about what universities like Carnegie Mellon do that these are fairly simple organizations. The reality is that the value proposition for universities is extraordinarily complex, in my view. If it weren't complex, we'd be businesses. We'd be firms. We'd all be for-profits, and we'd all be operating in markets, and we'd simply pay attention to what markets do, like all of you do, and respond accordingly and survive or not survive on that basis. But the fundamental value proposition in universities is that we're something beyond that. That is, we're what economists call a public good. That is, there's some activity that goes on at universities which can't effectively be valued in markets, which can't effectively be priced, and as a consequence would be underprovided to society if universities didn't exist in the forms in which they exist right now. That's a difficult thing to wrestle with because it's not easy to measure. You don't get prices. You don't get a return on investment that is easy to capture in any kind of direct way. And so the changes that are going to occur are more speculative than they might be in other industrial sectors. So take what I say with a grain of salt. I will say that I suspect that it's not so much that what we do as universities will change, but really how we do it will change. That the fundamental nature of our contribution in this public good aspect will probably remain constant over time, but how we go about pursuing that, I think, will have to change. And concomitant with that, the organizational structure of universities is going to have to change. We are structured as an historical artifact of the ways in which we were established sometimes hundreds of years ago. It's probably not an efficient structure, even for the goals that we want to pursue now. So what I'm going to do in my talk is briefly describe the main forces I see changing universities, talk about what I see as their implications for the way universities operate and the way they're structured, and talk very briefly about how Carnegie Mellon is responding to those changes and where Adelaide, our activities in Adelaide, fit into that. So again, this is not a particularly complex model of university activity, but I'll say that it merits some attention. In the first point, probably many of the organizations that are represented in this room do research. Certainly almost every significant firm has research and development as part of its mission in some form or fashion. But the research that universities do is different than that, or at least the research that my universities do. So I use the term here, basic research, not as to contrast in the university meaning, which is basic versus applied research, but to contrast in the industry meaning, which is basic versus commercializable research, okay, or research that's undertaken for commercial purposes. Second, we engage in education, and again, many of the organizations represented in this room also engage in education. But education at universities presumably and arguably is different in some fundamental ways. And the ways in which these things differ are important to understanding the ways in which universities are going to change over time. So I want to spend just a minute talking about the public goods aspect of universities, particularly on the research and education dimension. Research in some context is inherently a public good. That's particularly true at a public policy school, where much of the research that our faculty conduct has to do with how society functions and how it can function better and how government in particular, but social organizations of all kinds, can influence the functioning of society to the good. The examples of this are actually quite important. I think there's sometimes a general sense that policy research at universities doesn't actually get us anywhere. But if you think over the broad span, I think that's really not true. Certainly in my field in economics, if you think about the nature of monetary policy, for example, 30 years ago, there's no question in my mind that we have a far better grasp on what drives money and society and inflation and economic activity than we did even a relatively short time ago in terms of the life of the discipline. But there's also an aspect to research in universities which is extremely important and which applies to research that's a lot like what you all might do in your firms. And that is, there's a foundational aspect to research in universities. If it were the case that research was entirely governed by market forces, which it conceivably could be, and it certainly is in many organizations, then I'd argue that basic research would be underprovided to society as a whole, and that society gains by, for example, the fact that Carnegie Mellon goes out and does research on polymer chemistry and makes that research available not on the basis of what the return the market will bring, but simply on the basis that this is basic science that can feed into the productive processes of firms throughout society. And so it's available in large part, the research that universities do, for free to society, because that's the social contribution that universities are making. The social contribution on education is a bit more controversial, and to highlight this controversy, I'll point to the following fact. Returns to tertiary education are extremely high. It's a difficult thing to measure, but in OECD countries, it may be the case that returns to a college education are as high as 15%. So you think about a world in which you can make an investment, and every year from now till the end of time, your annual income will be 15% higher than it would otherwise be, absent this investment, and it's not a bad deal. So the question that emerges is, why on earth won't markets simply accommodate this what seems to be an obvious investment? And there are a lot of reasons for that in the literature. Individuals are notoriously short-sighted in their investment portfolio, and particularly when it comes to things like education. We have a whole set of folks at Carnegie Mellon who study a field called behavioral economics that talks about how individual behavior deviates from the sort of rational model of how you might expect people to invest here. Individuals also face a variety of budget constraints that capital markets aren't completely adept at solving for them. But I think more importantly, the hypothesis that universities work under is that there are social returns to having an educated populace. Those social returns have to do with things like the fact that the more educated I am, the more likely I am to generate employment for others. The fact that if I'm more educated, my children are likely to have better outcomes than otherwise. The fact that educated people are more civically engaged in society. And so the returns aren't captured by the change in my income over time. So this hypothesis about education is extremely important, but I would say it's not uncontroversial. For example, there is a model of tertiary education which says that basically the only thing universities are about are figuring out who's a really smart person and then testing the heck out of them to assure they're a really smart person and then certifying that to the companies that eventually hire them. Okay. In that world, universities are not a particularly productive enterprise on the educational side. And I have to say that, unfortunately, there are a number of universities that operate in that model. I'm proud to say that I don't believe Carnegie Mellon is one of those. We are extremely focused on the value added that our educational programs produce for our graduates. But there's an underlying hypothesis that I think is going to be fundamentally challenged over time in this public goods model of universities. And it has to do with the nature of society itself. So the hypothesis for governments in funding universities is that somehow the society which these governments represent, whether those are cities or whether they're states or whether they're nations, can capture these externalities. That is, when I become more educated and I do this wonderful thing of producing jobs that other people can take because of that education, that somehow those jobs are going to accrue to the constituents of the politicians who've actually funded my university. And this has been a reasonable assumption for much of the history of universities. Whether that those constituents are local in terms of the city, whether they're regional in terms of states or whether they're national, it's not been a bad assumption about the way in which these externalities get captured by societies. But one of the things that I'll argue going forward is that the changes in the world are actually going to change that basic dynamic, and that universities are going to have to respond to that. Because if it does change, our place in the social order is up for grabs, in my estimation. Okay? Before I talk about those changes, I want to talk about one issue that I'm sure many of you feel strongly about. I've certainly heard it in my discussions here, and that is that universities are slow to change. Okay, and this quote from George Landau, although it's from 1993 and it relates to something quite different than globalization, I think it has a ring to it, right? I mean, the process of globalization is not actually new in the world. I mean, one could argue, as Thomas Friedman does in his book on that the world is flat, is that this process has been going on since Bretton Woods, right? So for 50 years, this process has been going on. And the fact that I'm standing up here and wondering how my university can adapt to the processes of globalization and the forces of change in the world that it stimulated may be testament that globalization is just now reaching into bowling alleys or something. I'm not sure. But it is a fact, and I think it's one of the issues that universities collectively have to confront. There are really two forces that I want to point to, and I'll try and do this briefly. One is a long-term force. By long-term, I mean over the last 40 or 45 years. So this graph, it's the only data I actually have. This graph represents the students per 10,000 capita in the world engaged in tertiary education. So this is not how many students are there, right? But it's actually a proxy for the level of education of any individual in the world. And I'm sure you'll realize that this is a phenomenal growth rate over the last 40 years. If you just look since 1950 or 1960 at this graph, what you see is effectively exponential growth in the per capita human capital represented by tertiary education in the world. I don't know of any other area that has sustained this kind of growth for such long periods of time. And it's an interesting question what accounts for this growth. I mean, one obvious hypothesis is that world incomes are growing. If you think that if you think tertiary education is a normal good or a luxury good, as we call it in economics, that is, if the demand increases more than proportionally with income, then you might expect to see pretty rapid growth. But this certainly far outpaces the growth in per capita income in the world by orders of magnitude. Okay, so that's not completely an explanation. There are lots of other explanations that have been offered. Certainly, labor force participation is probably a pretty persuasive case. Women, particularly, have been participating in the labor force in increasing numbers, and so growth in population doesn't necessarily represent the growth in the labor force across economies. But even there, the growth rates aren't sufficient to explain this. And there are a lot of other hypotheses, but I'd like to point to one that, because it serves my purpose here in the talk, that's come out recently. A couple of sociologists, actually. I'm not generally allowed to read sociologists' work, but their preference, not mine. But this is interesting. So the hypothesis that Schoffer and Meyer put forward is that this change is fundamentally a reflection of underlying transformations in society that have taken us from highly stratified societies in which there is relatively limited mobility across class stratas to societies that are much more open, much more democratic, that offer the opportunity for their citizens to be much more economically mobile, but also much more socially mobile, to have a stronger influence on the outcomes in those societies. And so that tertiary education, the benefit to an individual of tertiary education is not just the change in income that they might see over their lifetimes, but it's the change in their socioeconomic status and their sense of ownership in society. And the analysis that these folks do is actually, I find, quite compelling. It's a very detailed analysis. You always have to be careful when you deal with global trends in anything, education or income or poverty or anything else, that the data is pretty bad by and large. But it's an extraordinarily interesting hypothesis. We don't know whether it's cause or effect. We don't know which way the causality runs. But one thing we do know is that somehow, if you believe this, universities are extremely tied up in the evolution of the socioeconomic structure in society in ways that are you probably don't want to even try and disentangle at this point. The second force is a more recent force, and that is what we've commonly come to know as globalization. I won't go through the details. You guys have read probably more than I have on this topic, but here are the features which seem interesting to me from the standpoint of being a dean. One is human capital is extremely mobile these days. You know, when I was in graduate school, I remember my trade theory class, and we talk a lot about models of trade theory, and in general, a pretty strict assumption in those models was that labor wasn't actually mobile across national boundaries, or wasn't perfectly mobile across national boundaries. And of course, you know, you're a grad student, you don't know, you're not supposed to ask questions, so you raise your hand and you say, well, what happens if labor is mobile? And the answer you got, and this was back in the dark ages, but the answer you got was, of course, well, that's a problem, you know. But the reality is that it is today. And it may not be mobile strictly in the sense of people moving across national boundaries, but it is quite clear that skills are mobile globally now in ways that they have never been mobile before. Economies and societies are networked today in ways that they've never been networked before. The production process has changed. It doesn't reside in one place. Even the innovation process has changed. It doesn't reside in one place. I saw recently a statistic that says that 150 of the Fortune 500 companies have R&D enterprises in India, just in India. There was a case study done, and turns out that Microsoft's China research enterprise is the most productive research enterprise that Microsoft has. And so it's not just what we traditionally think about as outsourcing that is driving this networking, although that's an important part. Global supply chains are clearly a fundamental piece of the transformation that's going on. But it's also that the intellectual capital that's being generated in the world is being generated globally. It is not bounded by national boundaries. It is not bounded by firm locations in specific points at specific points in time. There are increasingly, from a university's perspective, there is an increasing level of competition as nations around the world come to recognize that the role universities have played in societies has been a positive one, and they have invested in these societies. So our markets are increasingly more competitive. And in addition, the opportunity cost of people accessing university education in a traditional mode has gone up dramatically. And this is one thing that I think is extraordinarily important for us, and that is the old mode, our old business model was go out and find the best intellectual capital you can find. We call them faculty, but you know, deans call them intellectual capital, and bring them into one place, set them up in Pittsburgh, and announce to the world, look, if you want access to this, then come to Pittsburgh, right? Well, you know, that was a viable model once. It is no longer a viable model, in my estimation. And it was sustainable only because, in some ways, we had monopoly positions as universities in these localized geographic markets, positions that don't exist anymore. Okay. And then finally, I'll note that despite the fact that nations are at least as slow to adapt as universities are, there is internationally convergence in policy. And this is going to make a big difference. It's a bit glacial, I know, by business standards, and I'm sure you all would like to see more of this, but it's happening, and it's clear it's happening, and this also is going to decrease the level of protection for universities and the market and extend the markets in which universities operate. So what are the implications? Yeah, I'll try and do this quickly. I think that we can no longer, as universities, rely on our physical location as the definition of how societies capture the externalities that universities generate. We have to be more connected to society. We have to make our case more tangibly that what we do can influence outcomes in industry, can influence outcomes in governments and policy, can influence outcomes in communities. And in order to do that, we've got to link our research and education processes in a more concerted fashion to the processes that go on in society. We've got to become more tied to industry. We've got to become more tied to policymakers. We've got to become more tied to one another, I think, as universities, in order to respond to these changes in the world. The second is we've got to become more flexible. We've got to be able to adapt institutional models more quickly than we have in the past. We have to become more connected to the global labor force. We have to become more part of that network that exists out there. Our students are no longer going to say, well, guess what? I want a global career, so I'm going to go to New York and get a job in a bank, and that'll give me a global career because they'll ship me around the world. That's not the way people's careers are going to evolve, not the way our graduates' careers are going to evolve. Moreover, the networks of global citizenry and global economic activity that we want to plug into are not bounded by geographic domains anymore. And finally, I think that it's really incumbent upon us as universities, if we're going to make the case that this public good aspect is really remains a viable means of functioning for universities, to connect to emerging societies. We believe that we have something to contribute to the ways in which societies evolve. But if we're not engaged with those societies directly, then we're not going to make that contribution. They are no longer going to come to us. I think Carnegie Mellon has been very good at this, not because we recognized all the forces of change that existed in the world and responded to them, but simply because that we've been an entrepreneurial organization by university standards for a long time. We are the only university in the top 20, ranked in the top 25 in the United States, that was founded in the last 100 years. And we didn't get from a local, technical, sort of regional institution to being 21st or 22nd in the world, depending upon which ranking you have, by sitting around and doing things the old-fashioned way. I just want to give you just some sense of some of the things that we've been doing at Carnegie Mellon. So right next door to my building, where the Heinz School is located, we put up what we call a collaborative innovation center. And the idea behind this collaborative innovation center is that we'd attract firms to come and sit next to our faculty, I mean literally sit next to our faculty, and engage in dialogue about the ways in which academic research can evolve over time and the ways at which it can be connected to industry. And so this has been focused around information technology because that's clearly a strength of what we do, but companies like Google and Intel and a myriad of other companies have decided that this model of co-location of their researchers and our researchers is an effective method of transferring basic knowledge generated at universities into commercializable knowledge generated in firms. In educational programs, we have an interesting program with General Motors in information technology management. And basically what this the interesting features of this program is, it's aligned with GM's internal training program. So we've got 50 GM employees a year that are in our program. They've gone through GM's internal training program. We know the content that they've covered in that program. We even give them some advanced standing credit for that content, and we develop curriculum that builds on the content that exists there because that's a reflection of what GM needs as an industry, or at least what it perceives it needs as an industry. And certainly they know better than I do. We have research ventures like SciLab. SciLab is a university-wide research center focused on information security. It's a collaborative effort between the Heinz School, between our engineering college, our business school, and our College of Humanities and Social Sciences. SciLab has gone around the world and said, look, information security is critical to the functioning not just of nations, but of the entire global economic system. Okay, so let's invest globally in the research that goes on here. This has been extremely challenging because you, some of you may know that intellectual property rules at universities are particularly rigid when it comes to dealing with these kinds of things. But Carnegie Mellon has adapted those rules because it sees the importance of having an impact on what is a clearly a policy issue that extends beyond national boundaries. I could go down the list. Many of you know the Software Engineering Institute. It has a multiple decades-long reputation of making the translation between academic research and society. We have a campus on the west coast of the United States in Silicon Valley, which is creating new models of education through learning by doing in collaboration with large firms on the west coast, Northrop Grumman being the first tenant on that. So I think that Carnegie Mellon is well situated to respond to these changes, but it's going to accelerate. It's going to accelerate for us. And the only way we're going to effectively respond to that, I think, is in collaboration with governments and with industry and with other universities. I think we can no longer act as if we are separate entities, and what happens at Carnegie Mellon and what happens at MIT are separate and distinct and not of relevance to one another. Well, I'll wrap up. I don't need to go through all these. I never get through all my slides anyway, so they're on the website. I say there are some challenges. One is, if we as universities deviate from this basic model, that is, if we move away from basic research, we're dead. Okay? The challenge is not to become firms and conduct commercializable research. The challenge is to connect the research that we do more directly to the processes of innovation that firms engage in society. I think it's a challenge we're up for. I think that that it's certainly something that's embedded in what we're trying to do in Adelaide. It's been embedded in what we're trying to do in Pittsburgh. And I would be very interested in conversations with any of you that have ideas about how we might do that going forward. So I'll stop there. Thanks so much for your time and attention. I really appreciate the warm turnout and reception here, and I look forward to many, many future days and visits to Adelaide.